Transportation and Economic Development for Monday, June the 11th, for the purpose of a work session on an ODOT grant application and a work session on Senate Bill 5517, Oregon Housing and Community Services. And so we have Mr. Marsh from ODOT. First, any guidance from LFO or?
No, I'll let Mr. Marsh.
Okay. You're up, Mike.
Thank you. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation here to request authority to apply for federal fund grant application of just shy of $4.5 million. This is through the Federal Reauthorization Act, the Transportation Equity Act, and is to provide for rehabilitation, repair, preservation of covered bridges around the state. Those bridges have to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. We send out a broad notification to cities and counties about this each year. We got quite a few requests back. We're forwarding those. We cover 16 covered bridges from 7 counties and 4 cities. The locals are concerned enough that they are going to pay the matching funds for these and request authority to apply for those grants. If we get approval, we'll come back for approval to expend.
Mike, out of these 16 that are listed, how many did not apply? I'm just trying to get a scope of magnitude of how many covered bridges Oregon is possessed of.
Madam Chair, these are the vast majority, the counties that are involved here are the vast majority of counties that have covered bridges. The biggest counties are Lane, Lynn, Marion, Lincoln, in terms of the number of covered bridges in the counties, although there are other counties that have them. Benton applied and has them. I'm not aware of a county that has more than 2 covered bridges that didn't receive an application here.
Great. Colleagues, any questions? Senator George.
Just that this is absolutely fantastic. Senator Yee and I fought and fought and fought trying to save these covered bridges. And what do you think the chances are we're going to prevail?
Madam Chair, in the past, we've had a very high success rate. The biggest problem has been the process of actually getting the funds from the federal government to us in a timely fashion. So hopefully that improves in the short run here, and we can come back next time and show what we accomplished with the monies.
Senator George, that question was delivered with such enthusiasm. Do I hear a motion perhaps moving within you?
Yes, Madam Chair. Move that we approve the ODOT grant application. Oops.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to point out that the grant applications are due to the feds tomorrow, so we won't have a chance to actually have the full Ways and Means Committee weigh in on this issue, but I'm going to go ahead and recommend that ODOT go ahead and get the application, and if for whatever reason that the full Ways and Means decides that they don't wish to pursue this, then we can always pull it back, but I just wanted to make sure that that was on the record.
Assuming, Senator George, that that little piece of information is in your motion, would you please continue?
All right. I recommend that we approve the submission of the grant application to the Federal Highway Administration for restoration and repair of historic covered bridges.
Colleagues, any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you. We need a carrier. Senator George, you did that with such enthusiasm. How'd you like to?
I would love to.
Okay.
Thank you.
A carrier. LFO, come back for just a second. This is going to go to full.
Correct. Yeah.
So it's got to be a member of full. So, Senator Verger, would you mind carrying?
I would love to carry it. I can't imagine anybody voting against the covered bridges.
All right.
I just watched the last mouth.
So we're going to close the work session on the ODOT grant application and open the work session on Senate Bill 5517. And colleagues, before I turn to LFO, we have this scheduled for 2 days. And so it is the chair's intention, unless there's objection from any of you, that we have a thorough and complete discussion today. But reserve the right to perhaps come back and do the work session tomorrow. But let's see how today goes. I just at least wanted to get that on the record as to the intention of the chair. And with that, I would ask Mr. Merced and Mr. Prager to come up because undoubtedly there are going to be questions of you two gentlemen. And I think the way that we would like to do this, barring objection from the committee, is to have LFO walk through, Ms. Deister, walk through the LFO recommendation. I'm sorry that you didn't receive this in a more timely way. I will tell you this has been the matter of a considerable amount of discussion at all sorts of levels in the building. And I don't fault Ms. Dyster for not getting it out sooner. I think she got it to us as soon as she had permission to go to press. So, Ms. Dyster, with
thank
that. And one last thing, colleagues, the audience, I'm going to excuse myself for a few minutes sometime before we're done to go testify on another bill. And so with apologies to the agency, I'll be gone for a few minutes. Okay, with that, Ms. Dyster.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it has been quite a while since we heard the Housing and Community Services budget. So I'm pleased that we'll get an opportunity to kind of walk through this step by step and hopefully refresh some memories today. And
may I just amplify on that for a minute?
Sure.
I also, as a courtesy to the agency, and because they have been so unbelievably helpful and cooperative in trying to get this all pulled together, I would really like this to be a dialogue and would invite the agency as we move through this. If you have comments, I presume you have seen this LFO recommendation, but I want to make sure that there's a clear pathway for you to offer any comments to the committee as well. So I make that invitation to you not just to sit there but to be as proactive in your participation as you'd like to be. This is an important budget, and I want to make sure that the committee has the benefit not only of LFO's thinking but also the agency's thinking as we as a committee discuss it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have my team here to answer any question and to really engage in a thorough conversation. We also have folks that are watching this on the monitor so they can text message any questions that we're unable to answer immediately for us. So.
Good. And I would invite you to use your discretion to call up whoever you think would enrich the conversation as we move through. Okay?
Okay.
Now, back to you, Ms. Dyster.
Well, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends a budget of just over $2 billion and 140.42 FTE for the Housing and Community Services Department budget. Now, this is the budget bill only. This has nothing to do with the policy bill, House Bill 3551, that you folks heard a couple of weeks ago. So I want to put that out there right now. We're at this point, we're looking at those two things separately. So this is the budget only that you heard back in February. Continued general fund support at the essential budget level for those programs that had previously in the 05-07 session received general fund support, and those were the general fund food program, the emergency housing account, and the state homeless assistance program and the home ownership assistance program.
Madam Vice Chair?
Yes, Representative Hannah.
Thank you. Ms. Dyster, in the first paragraph it says the recommended budget includes the 44.2% increase.
Mm-hmm.
The additional general fund investment will be used to enhance food-related programs and preserve existing
right.
affordable housing.
Right.
Then under these bullet points that say they're going to be essential budget level,
right.
it lists those very things.
Right. The enhancement to the general fund food program is discussed in a policy option package, Package 104. Okay, and in terms of homelessness assistance, there is a separate policy option package associated with that as well.
Thank
so
you.
I'm
so we'll cover that as we go.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. So just as an overview, I want to kind of talk about all of the policy option packages generally, and then we'll drill down into the separate program units. That was the way in which it seemed easiest for me to try to communicate what was going on here. And please, once again, stop me and ask me questions as we're going along. So the following policy option packages are assumed in the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation. And in some cases, we've modified those, and when we drill down to the program unit level, we'll talk about what those modifications are. But just generally, so that you know, package 070 is a revenue shortfall. That's an essential budget package. Basically, we had a situation with Housing and Community Services where you'll recall them discussing the fact that the economic downturn earlier in the decade, 01 to 03, set up a situation in which they had a number of dynamics, which included customers prepaying their loans and folks finding competitive market loan rates, which caused some of their revenues and their portfolios to diminish quite a bit. So they had to do some, make some changes to their personnel levels in order to balance revenue with expenditures. So that's basically the reason behind Package 070. Package 101 was titled Maintaining Excellence, and it includes updated projections of federal funds, and it also includes a couple of enhancements, which include a general fund appropriation to the Program Outreach and Accountability Unit, which will be discussed in detail when we get there, that actually enables them to buy back a couple of those positions that they lost in the 070 package. Package 102 is called Housing and Services for Oregonians. Now, there are two component parts to this particular package. One is the preservation package, which basically has to do with preserving affordable rental housing units that have federal Section 8 subsidy contracts that are about to expire. And then the other component is lottery revenue bonds to fund supported housing for the homeless. As it was originally presented to you, this particular package stretched across two different program units. Legislative Fiscal is recommending that we consolidate all of those into one program unit so that we can more easily report on it and we can more easily administer it, and Housing and Community Services agrees with this approach, actually asked us to do this at their instigation. So you'll see the puts and takes and the changes as we move through the ORBITS reports about exactly how that happened. And then lastly is Policy Option Package 104, Building Local Capacity. This is where you see the enhancement to the General Fund Food Program. So that's basically it for the brief overview. If I could stop there if anyone has any questions. Otherwise, we'll move on and start the drill down. Okay. So if you look at the Energy and Weatherization Program, you'll recall that this is the program that helps families meet, this is the program that helps with installing energy-saving modifications, home weatherization projects, and bill payment assistance. And the Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending a budget of $99,167,843 and seven full-time equivalent positions for this program. You'll notice that the majority of those dollars are federal funds. Package 070, this program does have a reduction option here, Package 070, which LFO is recommending approval of. That package basically eliminates a 1.0 FTE Office Specialist 2 position. The resulting dollars associated with that. What you won't see a decline in the FTE between 0507 and 0709 because there was also an 060 package, which doesn't show up on your budget report, that transferred a position from another program unit to energy and weatherization. Now, that other program unit position was funded with other funds. It's my understanding that this transfer is going to be a federally funded position. So this has the impact of making being able to maintain a position in a place where it's needed, but using federal funds instead of what had previously been funded with other funds in the other program unit. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it doesn't show up on your ORBITS report because ORBITS only shows 070 and upwards in terms of package numbers. But I can get that detail for any of you who would like it. Okay. Policy Option Package 101, Maintaining Excellence. What you're seeing here is the update of the federal funds projections that I talked about previously. The Low-Income Energy Assistance Program and which is funded by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. We're seeing additional allocations from that program that we did not expect, and so we've updated those federal funds projections, and the department expects that they'll be able to get allocations out the door to their local partners who distribute these dollars on an income basis more effectively than they have in the past. So that's the reason for Package 101.
Question. What's the lag time behind the rising energy cost until the federal contribution goes up? So, I mean, what we're saying here is rising energy costs have resulted in increased federal allocation for the program. How long ago are we talking about energy costs going up that the allocation got increased?
Well, you may also recall, Representative Hanna, if I can jump in there, that at the, I believe it was the August Emergency Board, we started to see an additional expenditure limitation for this particular program due to that very thing. This is a continuation of it, but I don't know how far back it went.
Well, and let me just, I mean, because we've just seen the federal lawsuit and the 13% increase in electricity rates for many, many Oregon customers. Again, I'm asking the question to know what the lag is. We're seeing energy prices that could be soaring if your home is electric. So,
Vice Chair Tomei, Representative Hanna, Nancy Kane, Chief Financial Officer and Interim Community Resource Division Administrator. That is not a direct one-for-one. We have seen energy assistance and weatherization dollars increase sort of gradually over the last probably three or four biennia. The federal government does not react immediately. We do not expect at this time to see a great increase in our 2008 budget from the federal government. It's possible with some push from Congress that we would see an increase, but actually this is just, we're just anticipating maintaining at this point what we've received in the past three or four years.
Can I follow up? Just, and I'll leave it alone after that. Is there a correlation between the number of requests for assistance based on every percent or two of increase in energy cost?
There are a number of factors that go into both the total amount of federal funds awarded and both that and then the distribution among the states, and part of that distribution among the states is energy costs and the number of low income. It does take a couple of years for those to catch up, and we do get into a situation where because of our moderate climate, sometimes we are actually overlooked, or we sometimes feel that we don't get our fair share as much as we would like. This is particularly true in what we refer to often as contingency funds from the Low Income Energy Assistance Program. Because we are often competing with, you know, the Boston, Maine, New York areas with a lot of people at very low temperatures, we are not, even with our increase now, we're often competing with those type of situations. So we do try to make sure that we are being considered, and certainly this increase in rates will be something that we take to our congressional delegation and make them aware that Oregon does need additional funds.
Thank you. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a perfect lead-in for my question.
when you look at this state, and so many times we see our folks not getting a fair share no matter what the issue is, but when we have federal policy on our oceans and in our timber that have so greatly affected our economy and therefore affected, you know, the working families of Oregon, do we get any consideration for the impacts of federal decision and policy?
Vice Chair Tomei, Senator George, I can't answer that directly. I know that certainly our agency has been more proactive in making the needs as we become aware of them, the needs of Oregonians, particularly low Oregonians. We communicate more and more with our congressional delegation and have opened up dialogues to make them aware of issues as we see them. And also the governor's office does have a federal liaison in Washington, D.C., Sarah Bittleman. And our office, our agency, has been pretty proactive in having Ms. Bittleman assist us where we see impacts to our particular programs not meeting the needs of the Oregonians that we serve.
You're welcome. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I wanted to follow up on an earlier answer. Did you indicate that this federal funds expenditure limitation will allow us to maintain the current population receiving assistance under this program?
Vice Chair Tomei, Representative Edwards, it has increased over the level of federal funds has right. increased over gradually over time. Historically, we've had to come back to E-Board and get additional limitation. So this is really to just bring us up to where we should be. And at our level of expectations, we at this time are not expecting an increase in funds. For instance, in the 2007, as you all may be aware, we really actually never got a budget from the federal government. They never got it out. It was through continuing resolution, and our 2007 level was just funded at our federal year 2006. And at this point, actually, we're fighting to, we're hoping to get our 2008 levels at least equal to our 2007. So this is really a cumulative effect of several years of increases.
One quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So given that level of increase, are you able to maintain the size of the population that's being served, or are you even able to expand it?
Chair, Senator Johnson, Representative Edwards, that is something that we're actually looking at different mechanisms because certainly on the low-income energy assistance program, we have not been able to expand again. The amount that is awarded to individuals has remained constant, and in order to keep our the numbers served, we have not been able to raise that amount very much. We are actually looking at different ways of allocating those funds or awarding those funds. Now, generally, you get a family that's eligible gets a set amount. Different families, different individuals have different levels of needs, and in some cases, because most of the time we use a standard award or allocation, they may have a credit where, in the meantime, someone else who perhaps needs a higher level is left still owing money on their bill. The other thing is that it is, well, we certainly hope that we can get more funds, especially since we've seen this increase. We also need to, we feel that a need to expand the numbers served. Currently, between the low-income energy assistance program, which is federal, and the Oregon Energy Assistance Program, which is the bill payment assessment charge out of 1149 out of the 1999 session, we are only able to serve less than 20%, provide assistance to less than 20% of low-income Oregonians who would be eligible. And we can't really determine whether they would come in for service or present for service, but looking at the incomes, we're serving 20% of those just income-based that would be eligible if we had the funds.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
I think it was important for the record to understand the level of service being provided. Despite the increase, it looks as though we're still short of serving the eligible population.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Dicer.
Okay. Moving on to the Self-Sufficiency and Emergency Assistance Program. These are the services that are provided to very low-income Oregonians to help them meet short-term daily needs for food and shelter. They include rental assistance programs, help with rental assistance payments, homeless assistance, which is help for those who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless, food programs, which include a number of state as well as federal types of programs as well, federal commodity programs through the Department of Agriculture. So the Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending a budget of $142.8 million for the Self-Sufficiency and Emergency Assistance Program and $22.42 million full-time equivalent positions, 23 positions. Again, we have a revenue shortfall component to the policy option packages that LFO is recommending for approval, package 070. And if you look on page 5 of your Orbitz report, that'll give you some detail. The narrative there in the tiny prints in the far left-hand margin. We'll talk a little bit about what specifically is included. It's an $89,453 other funds adjustment associated with package 070. And that basically is the elimination of 0.58 FTE in the Asset and Property Management Division, which is a Principal Executive Manager C. And again, that's necessary to balance the department's budget before you add in additional policy option packages. So. Policy Option Package 101, Maintaining Excellence. We're recommending approval of that policy option package. Again, the specifics of what's included there, if you look on page 6, this package increases federal funds limitation by $3.5 million for the 07-09 biennium due to, again, updated federal funds projections. These are federal programs, the Continuum of Care Grant and the Home Tenant-Based Assistance Program. The Home Tenant-Based Assistance Program specifically is low-income rental assistance payments. So, again, those are updated projections associated with that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you. Ms. Deister, perhaps you can answer this question. Are we collecting interest, then, on the principal invested in that fund? I wasn't quite sure. The description of the package on the second page of the staff summary was somewhat confusing.
I'm sorry, where are you?
For package 101. On the second page, on the description, indicates that it adds $2 million in the general fund and the interest of from those funds are used to buy back the two positions.
Right.
I want to verify that the state treasurer is responsible then for managing the interest on behalf of the agency. Is that the way it works?
Basically, we're going to talk about that when we get to the administration program of the of the agency. But because that goes into that $2 million is basically going to be deposited into the housing finance account, which is the department's main account that a lot of their business components move through. So that interest then would be available to the department agency to use for those particular positions, if you'd like to.
And I'm going to ask the agency to comment on that, because we've had a series of kind of lively discussions about whether or not that's working money or whether that's just resting money. And I would invite Mr. Krager's response.
Madam Chair, thank you. Again, for the record, Rick Krager, Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. First of all, to answer Representative Edwards' question, when we do get to that $2 million, that is money that would be sitting in the state treasurer's office and managed through the short-term fund and enabling us to draw interest off for program use. To also respond to Madam Chair's question, that we have had some discussions about that $2 million. It is our intent to put that money to work, and I know that when we get to the LFO recommendation, that's going to be part of the discussion as opposed to the money sitting in Treasurer. Our intent is to begin making this money work in the form of a pre-development loan, of which we've been very successful in the past. So I know that Ms. Deister will get to that at some point, but I just want to put that on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You anticipated my follow-up question.
Good. We'll get to that. That's in the chapters ahead.
Coming attractions.
Okay.
Okay. So, where was I?
You were.
Okay. I was at one policy option package 102, I believe.
Right.
Okay. So, housing and services for Oregonians. Remember, this is the package with the two component parts. Now, what we've done with this particular, in this particular instance, is we've transferred the amounts for this package that were in the governor's recommended budget under this program unit, and we've moved them to another program unit, which is the Homeownership and Affordable Rental Housing Programs program unit. Okay, so if you look on your Orbitz report, you're going to see a bunch of very large negative numbers for program unit number 200. But you'll see those amounts added back into program unit 400. Okay, so that's basically what's going on there, and I'll explain the particulars of what exactly is being added back in just a minute. So, with regard to Policy Action Package 104, this is the building local capacity. If you look on page 6, again, in the narrative for your Orbitz report, you'll see this is the part that increases support for the Oregon Food Bank. Basically, there's $1.6 million in additional dollars for the Oregon Food Bank. And there's also a fund shift in here. The governor's recommended budget recommended moving a position that was funded with other funds to general fund. LFO does not recommend that particular portion of this package. So the positions stay where they previously were. And we also, not included in this particular portion of the recommendation, was the governor's recommendation for the Food Policy Council, which added a couple of positions, and some about $340,000 in funding. So that is not included in the LFO recommendation.
Okay.
Matt.
Mr. Krager.
I just, Madam Chair, just to clarify real quick, and Michelle's done an excellent job in summarizing that. I did want to point out, I think her comment was that it was $1.6 million that went to the Oregon Food Bank. The amount was actually $1.3 or $1.274. What the $1.6 included was the Oregon Food Policy Council as well as the contribution to the Oregon Food Bank. So I just wanted to make sure that we were clear that the $1,274,000 that's on the on page 7 of your Orbitz report is the amount that go to Food Policy Council. And I think the recommendation that Michelle was just referring to, the subtraction of the Food Policy Council, is also highlighted there as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I didn't read all the way down. So,
so moving on to community capacity building.
All right. Community capacity building. These are basically a number of what I sort of like to consider in my mind as some more miscellaneous types of programs within the Department of Housing and Community Services. They include programs such as the Commission on Voluntary Action and Service, the administration of individual development accounts. There are regional housing, one-stop regional housing centers that are administered in this particular program. And also federal community service block grants are also administered through this particular program.
And one, colleagues, that I think is of particular note to all of us, because I'm sure at one time or another we've all heard from constituents affected, the Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations Program that I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Fager, has helped you with a program that you oversee where parks want to buy, where the tenants want to buy the park. And there have been instances where that has worked out very satisfactorily. So that's an important element of this program.
The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending a budget of $29.2 million for the Community Capacity Building Program and 10 positions, 10 full-time equivalent positions. Again, we have a package 070 associated with this particular program. And the details of that are on page 8 of your Orbitz report. If you look there, you'll see that I just need to make sure I'm in the right program unit here. A reduction of 132,713 other funds and $56,461 in federal funds. And one FTE, the position being eliminated is an operations policy analyst 3. And again, that's to balance expected expenditures with available revenue.
Okay, questions, colleagues? Representative Edwards.
Madam Chair, is it your preference to review all the budget notes together?
No, I think let's stick with talking about them as they come through, because this is designed to be a very thorough discussion of this document before we move ahead.
Yeah, I would like an explanation, perhaps, from the agency about this budget note.
Okay. Again, as I mentioned previously, I sort of refer to some of these items as more of a miscellaneous. In the particular instance here, I've got a budget note included in my recommendation that basically calls for a study of a couple of these programs to see whether or not they can be spun off to more of an independent status, or whether or not perhaps other agencies might be better suited to administer these particular programs. And it's the fiscal office's hope that the department would work collaboratively with those who might be a better fit, or with the entities themselves, to determine whether independent status is warranted and how that might work, how that transition might work, or whether it's feasible to transition them out of the department and therefore save some administrative costs.
I don't think this budget note anticipates an outcome. It just invites the inquiry.
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, it's a very good exercise for the department to undergo as we streamline and look at ways to become more efficient. So whether anything happens as a result of the study, you know, it's to be determined later, but I think it's an excellent exercise for the department to go through.
Other questions? Okay, homeownership, affordable rental housing development.
Okay. This is the program that basically is what you might consider more of the business portfolio of the Housing and Community Services Department. This is their market rate loans and their mortgage programs, their down payment and closing cost assistance programs, their financing programs, tax credit programs, etc. These are the various programs that are anticipated in the consolidated funding cycle, for example, when entities come forward and apply to Housing for Funding. Most of those are included in this particular program unit. So there are a number of programs, individual line item type of programs in here, but they, for the purposes of agency organization, they're all in under this umbrella, SCR umbrella. So the Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending $1,875,698,769 and 54.00 full-time equivalent positions associated with this particular program. And we will...
Senator Bridger.
How would I know if that's... I mean, that's... I'm not challenging the figures. Actually, where do I see interest income and so forth? Do I not see it in any of this particular program?
Generally speaking, in terms of the interest income that is associated with the particular agency's various portfolios, I believe you would be looking at the annual financial statements for the Department of Housing and Community Services. You'd also, by looking there, get an indication of what their cash balances are, how much business that they've been doing, and that sort of thing as well. So that's all part of an evaluation that gets rolled up. And it's one component of a much, much larger, what you're seeing is a much larger piece here, a much more bird's eye view.
But perhaps what Senator Bridger is asking is, I think it's the goal of everybody on this panel to see people with roofs over their heads and safe and dependable living arrangements. And how, when we're working on a budget of this magnitude, do you have a sense that there is return on investment? For this much money, how many people are sheltered or have a chance at home ownership? And maybe the agency can fill us in a little bit to have this a very high-level look-see. Refresh our memories, given that it was a long time ago that you were here before the committee talking about the program elements in this part of your portfolio. So maybe you could help us a little bit. Senator Virgin, did I take too many liberties with your question?
No, you didn't. But it just seems to me that, you know, this department, just kind of the bird in the tree look, this department has been well managed in a lot of ways, but it's also built up quite a financial business for the return on investment through interest returns and so forth. And so in looking at this, I am not able to really ascertain whether those numbers are good numbers or what those numbers really mean, and you did not take too much liberty at all.
Okay, Mr. Berger.
Madam Chair, Senator Verger, I'm trying to figure out the best way to answer this question, and I think you're asking a good business question. You know, how do we know that we're continuing to operate well? How do we know that we're getting the best financial return for our money? And as Ms. Dicer alluded to, I mean, from a business standpoint, we do depend on our annual we're constantly looking at our cash flows, our annual financial report. Part of the report here is, as you know, the program reductions. And as we've discussed before, we've had some challenges over the last several years with the economics, particularly in the bond market, and that's what's caused us to create some of the program reductions, or I should say staffing reductions that we have undertaken. So if you're wanting to get into maybe some discussion of how much of this is interest income, how much of this is bond proceeds, I'd probably have to work with staff to take these numbers apart a little bit further for you. I don't have that specifically right here at this time, but I can assure you that we do, on an annual basis, are looking at our cash flows, managing our profits. We have been successful. There is a business side here that we have to manage constantly. So I'm stumbling with your question here a little bit.
No, I don't want to penalize anyone for running a good business. That's very good, and you've done that. I guess that what I would like to make sure of, where we are trying to meet the needs of so many different people, that that the department is also turning their success into less dependency on other ways of finance. Does that make sense to you?
Madam Chair, Senator Verger, certainly as we have generated, one of our goals is to generate additional monies to be able to help our programs in other areas.
And you've done well with it.
And I think where we have gotten with this budget is we've kind of come to this point where we can't continue to do that because of some of the problems that we have sustained financially over the time. So I think what you see with this budget is there are some general fund requests that we're asking for, and to be able to manage those into our business processes to be able to meet some of those needs. I think we've taken it as far as we can, at least without, you know, doing additional type, meeting additional program needs. I think we've done a very good job on the home ownership as well as the rental housing.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Council. During the interim, we worked with Unappropriate Legislative Revenue on some degree, looking at the various different home ownership versus the rental policies. And it certainly appeared from our figures that your rental efforts were making considerable money and your home ownership was losing considerable money. I do understand that part of the home ownership program was losing money because of negative interest arbitrage, and as I understand it, much of your administrative cost comes from interest income on that home ownership program. But could you tell the committee why it is in the best interest of putting more people in affordable homes to continue to emphasize the home ownership program as opposed to putting the money into putting more money into rental residences and renovation of existing HUD programs that are about to that you either have to buy out or they're going to do something else with. Could you help us with that?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, I'm familiar with the analysis that you're referring to that staff took on. I think there were some missing components in that analysis, to be quite frank. I think that if you look at the analysis, one can interpret, well, home ownership isn't making any money, rental housing is making all the money. But what the factor that's missing there is that home ownership program has basically provided the administrative money that this department has needed for the last 14 years. So what you don't see in that is if you look at a home ownership financial column, you say, well, it's breaking even, or maybe it's losing a little money, but what's not counted there is the money that was taken out of that particular program to pay for the entire 50% of the operations for this department. So I would say to that particular analysis, while looking from the naked eye that, okay, this doesn't look like it's making money, I think there was some missing components in it that would need to be looked at further. In terms of the answer to your other question, home ownership versus rental housing, I think both of them, there are a lot of needs for both rental as well as home ownership. If you look from a state benchmark standpoint, we are still under what the state benchmark is in terms of home ownership for the state of Oregon. There's a lot of needs still out there. Our program has been very successful in meeting the people that are 100% area, I should say from 70 to 100% area median income, with special emphasis on individuals that are 80% and below. We've been very successful. These are people that are now owning their own home. So I think that both elements are important. I think we're very good at both elements in providing those, and home ownership has been a very successful program for us over the years.
Follow up.
When I framed my question, I did mention the fact that you do get a good part of your administrative revenue from that program, and I did mention the negative interest arbitrage. But the question was, is it a better investment for the department? Will it put more people in a safe, warm place to live by emphasizing the rental part as opposed to the home ownership part?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, I think that from the standpoint of success, putting money into the home ownership program, typically we can get about 1,500 to 2,000 families in a home each and every year. These are low-income people. From the rental side of the equation, We're looking at typically between both of our programs, somewhere around 2,000 units per year that we're able to create. And again, that's a variety. I mean, that's usually typically your 60% area median income and below. Some of them are very, very low income. What's the best investment? I think that both in both cases, we are able to leverage the money that we have to provide a need in both areas.
I think one of the issues might be of the people that you place in homes.
Mm-hmm.
What's the survivability rate? Maybe you could refresh our memory from your presentation. What all is in your toolbox to put people in homes, whether it's mortgage assistance or counseling or other elements that elude me right now from your previous presentation. But of those people that you're placing into homes of their own with assistance, what's the survivability quotient?
Meaning
that they are still in a home a year, 2 years, 5 years?
Madam Chair, let's talk home ownership first. In terms of survivability, how long do we keep people in? Typically, we see our mortgages ranging anywhere from 7 to 10 years. That's the life of our particular loan. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're gone. They may be refinanced into another loan or something else. So typically, that's the long-term piece that we have, that what we're seeing in terms of average loan life. In terms of our toolbox, the biggest program that we have is a residential loan program. That's the issue of tax-exempt bonds to provide the mortgages. That's the biggest portion of this budget that you see here. We also have a small general fund contribution of into our homeownership assistance program that provides down payment assistance. It also provides homeowner counseling through our ABCs of home buying. We also use it to develop our regional housing centers that are kind of the one-stop shop for individuals that are looking for a variety of needs. So that's a small general fund contribution that we have there. We have also been able to take our bond programs, and because we have a large resource there in our tax-exempt authority, and create more down payment assistance, because one of the biggest challenges for individuals in getting into homes is that not only, you know, having the loan itself, but the down payment assistance that is necessary to get there. So we have been able to leverage our bond programs to do that more effectively. What am I forgetting? I think those are the two key areas of home ownership. In terms of rental housing, in this particular program unit, we use a variety of resources through, I think Ms. Dyser explained our consolidated funding cycle. We use tax credits. We use monies from the federal government, home dollars. We use public purpose charge money that we use for what is called our housing trust fund. We blend all these money to create a variety of units through our CFC process. And typically, again, we're seeing probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 to 1,200 units that we're able to produce through that particular process, and then on our bond side, about another 800 to 900 units of rental housing that we're able to do. So that's sort of, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, in a nutshell, kind of the toolkit, if you will.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You must report to a policy committee, and I'm just wondering which one you report to.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, we report to that our housing council is the member that is oversight for our department. It's seven members.
So you don't come to a legislative committee, a policy committee. You just come to the Ways and Means Committee?
Your policy bills, when if you have policy-related bills related to housing, what committees have you been before this particular session, I believe? Is that the question?
Yes. Thank you.
In terms of our policy bills in front of the legislative, I mean, we've had a variety of committees. This has typically been the Transportation Economic Committee has been our committee in the past that we have confronted.
That's for your budget bill.
Uh-huh.
Like your manufactured housing type bills, what policy committees have those gone before?
Those have been through the John, help me out.
While he's coming up, House colleagues, I've just asked to make sure that you're noted as excused until there's a call, because I think you come back in at 2.
But if you have legislation you're carrying or any other reason, please feel free to excuse yourselves.
Madam Chair, before John speaks, Representative Tomei, I think what Rick was alluding to is that our housing council is where typically the department presents our policy packages and our policy initiatives for their blessing, and that we submit those through the legislative process. And John can tell you which committees we've had.
Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, I'm John Fletcher, the Senior Policy Advisor for the department. We have been before several different committees this session. There is no particular one committee that deals specifically with housing. There are other states like Washington. They have a legislative interim housing committee devoted to housing issues. We don't have that structure here. And so we've been before the General Government Committee for some bills. We've been before the Consumer Protection. We've been before Economic Development, Interim Policy Committees. It varies. Land Use Committees. So there have been probably about 8 different groups we've been before this session, instead of having one particular group that we could go to and keep working the issues. So.
It does raise an interesting question with respect to some of the policies that guide the agency, because you're talking to your own advisory groups that are your internal sounding board. But to the degree that, let's just pick one, mortgage assistance is one that I had asked about earlier, and I think others have asked for. Many of us have had the experience of buying a first home and not getting assistance for a variety of reasons. Obviously, economic thresholds is one of them. But just what motivates the philosophy of providing mortgage assistance? Who picks the winners? Who picks the losers? How are those monitored? What's the long-term survivability rate of people that are assisted that way? And I think it's those kinds of policies that I don't know if they're refreshed in the legislature periodically or they're refreshed at your own housing council. And that was what I think some of us were quizzical about in your earlier presentation.
You have my housing administrator come here and respond to that.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Gillespie. And the survivability rate of our single-family loans, we generally have a default rate of around 2%. So we do quite well, you know, as far as the loan portfolio. And the way the loans are made is actually we have lenders all around the state that participate in our programs. They're private institutions, and we simply act as a purchaser of those loans. So they're doing the qualifications of that. And roughly 50% of our loans can have the down payment assistance. We issue what are called premium bonds that allow a 3% down payment assistance. And for that, the borrower actually pays a 0.5% interest rate more. So they make the choice at the local lenders as to which is the best avenue for the particular borrower, whether to have the down payment assistance of the 3% and 0.5% interest rate less, or to have the loan that doesn't have the cash assistance.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you. What's the cutoff point for a loan? $500,000 house, $250,000,
$175,000. It does vary by county. I'd have to get that information back to you. Usually, it's the income of the person that's going to be the cutoff point, not the value that FHA allow us to loan to. But I'd have to go back and research that for you.
And is that income level prescribed someplace in rule or in statute or? What are your guidelines, your internal guidelines?
Many of our loans are FHA insured or they're conventionally insured. It's only if loans are 80% loan to value or less. So the FHA sets the standards for those that have the FHA insurance, that type of credit enhancement. And then it'd be other credit enhancers that you would see in the market. There would be the others that are setting the terms on what would be the maximum debt that a particular household could handle.
Okay.
additional information.
I know. We're waiting. Play called in from the sidelines. Do you want to come up and make the comment yourself?
Yeah, because I didn't quite get all that.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, we issued tax... For the record, my name is Nancy Kane.
Thank you.
And I guess in this capacity, I'm Chief Financial Officer. We issue tax-exempt bonds, and so the IRS sets the limits by county on both the limits of the income and the amount, the purchase amount.
Thank you.
And then in addition to not having an income that exceeds the IRS rate, at the same time you have to qualify for those loans, so you have to have sufficient income to afford those loans. So there's that dual qualification.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Let us keep moving ahead in deference to the time.
All right. So, if moving along to the policy option package recommendations associated with this particular program, we recommend approval of policy option package 070, eliminating 2.5 FTE as follows: a compliance specialist 3 position, which is responsible for inspecting properties that are financed using some department resources. An operations and policy analyst 3 position, which is an agency liaison with the economic revitalization teams, as well as program support for farm worker housing development account and the housing tax credit program for farm workers. The department will absorb these responsibilities into existing positions and maintain support to the economic revitalization teams, and that includes a point. There's also a 0.5 FTE office specialist 2 position reduction associated with that.
Senator Whitson.
Your second point there, the operations and policy analyst 3 position,
mm-hmm.
is the agency liaison reserve. Is that another one of those governor's positions that is paid for by the agency, in this case, the office of housing?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, it's my understanding that the actual economic revitalization team position resides in the governor's office. This was merely support for that particular function that was paid for through housing, and I would invite you to amplify if necessary.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, staff said it very well. I mean, that's exactly what this position was designed to do, was to be the connection between the economic revitalization team and our staff and working with our regional advisors to the director. We had a position that had done that work, as well as working on the farm worker housing development issues. What we're elected to do with the abolishment of this position is absorb that within the existing staff and do some restructuring that will enable us to still meet those needs. But to clarify, this is not one of those positions that is staffed in the governor's office as one of the advisors.
Okay. So you will see that the dollars associated with that 070 package amount to $431,321 other funds and 3 positions, which equate to 2.50 FTE. With regard to policy option package 101, if you'll go ahead and turn to page 11 of that Orbitz report, you're looking here at a $4 million federal funds limitation increase. Again, this is updates of those federal funds projections that have been common in the previous programs as well. The particular source of these dollars are the Community Development Block Grant Program and the Home Investment Partnership Program. Again, they're looking at receiving slightly more than originally anticipated in the governor originally anticipated in previous biennia from those particular federal sources. It also establishes a couple of positions. This is where we get to the. Wait a second here. This actually establishes 2 positions, primarily funded through federal funds, to support those particular programs. So you're looking at the addition of a compliance specialist position to monitor some of the 1,070 programs, or 1,070 multifamily housing projects, and a program analyst 3 position dedicated to home ownership assistance. We're recommending that the program analyst 3 addition be limited duration in the 07-09 biennium so that we can monitor whether or not federal funds are maintained at the levels that are expected. Those may be volatile in future biennia, and we wouldn't want to have to come back and eliminate a permanent full-time position. Mr. Kroger.
I just wanted to clarify, just so that the committee is aware, this position has been a limited duration position for the previous
two
biennia, and this was established with the American Dream Down Payment Initiative, signed in law by the president several years ago, and it's been sort of that. It's been established as a limited duration position each and every year because of the uncertainty if that federal money was going to come back. So far, it's been coming back each and every year, so that's the reason we're back here again. We concur with staff's recommendation that this be limited duration reevaluated again in 2 years.
Okay. So then we move on to policy option package 102, and this is where it starts to get complicated, so please stop me. Again, remember, we're doing a couple of things here. We're moving dollars that were originally in the governor's budget in the other program unit. We're all consolidating them now into the home ownership and affordable rental housing program. So that's part of what you're going to be seeing in Orbis. So what you've got going on here, then, are the two components to this particular package. One of those is the preservation component. Now, to refresh your memories, preservation basically involves helping to provide gap financing to help third parties acquire projects with federal subsidies that are about to expire. Those federal Section 8 housing subsidies are going to be expiring between now and the year 2013, I believe. There are a series of them that are going to expire. They are expected to be renewed, but at a lower rate in the future. And so those who currently have those particular subsidies may not choose to renew them. What they may choose to do instead is convert what was previously affordable housing to market rate housing, because they're not going to be getting as large of a subsidy from the federal government. So what we're talking about doing here is gap financing to allow another entity who might want to take these over at the lower federal subsidy rate once the contract is renewed to acquire those and continue those units as affordable rental housing. Did I get all of that? Okay. So, Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Krieger, among the eligible 84 properties, you're going to preserve a minimum of 300 units. How many preservable units are in those 84 properties?
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I would say of our portfolio, a population of 122 projects that we have in our finance portfolio, there are over 4,000 units that are available. So of the 84, we're estimating somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,500 to 3,000 units, and I'm going to look back to Ms. Labor and see if that's a good estimate. 84 projects, about 2,500 to 3,000 units?
Yes.
So the population of that 84, those 84, is about 2,500 to 3,000 units of affordable housing.
Follow. You're just going to preserve 300 of them.
That will be our minimum. That would be our minimum. We're hoping to be able to do a lot. Each deal is different depending on the amount of rehab that's needed in a particular project.
Projected maximum be?
The projected maximum, we said between 300 and 600 units. So I would, for the record, I'd say 600 units would be our maximum, but I'm hoping to be able to do more than that. Right now we're working on a deal. We're hoping to be able to preserve upward to 450 units out of 16 total projects. That would cost us about $2 to $3 million of gap financing. So that's a pretty good investment. So, but obviously we still have to work the details of the deal. We need some other commitments from other partners.
Okay. So with regard to this particular preservation package, as it was originally presented, oh, there goes my nameplate. As it was originally presented in the governor's recommended budget, the governor had recommended $8 million in general fund to fund this gap financing for preservation. The legislative fiscal office is recommending reducing the general fund by $3 million and using other sources of departmental funding to make up that amount to get to a total amount of $8 million. And if you look in your memo, there's a very long explanation of how exactly we managed to do that, and I'll walk through it now with you, and you can stop me as you have questions. Okay, the Housing Development and Guarantee Account, which is often referred to as the Housing Trust Fund, includes a corpus or principal, which is held by the Housing and Community Services Department. That corpus is used as collateral to guarantee loans to finance the construction, development, acquisition, and rehabilitation of low-income housing. Basically, this corpus was created in 1991 with $14 million in general fund and $1.5 million later added through lottery proceeds in 1993. No further contributions beyond that $15.5 million have been made to the corpus, but several biennia ago, $5.53 million was transferred from the corpus to the state general fund to assist in the recession and fund other particular programs of the state. So interest earnings on another program, the Community Incentive Fund bond proceeds, and the interest on the remaining Housing Trust Fund corpus have been used then to repay to get us back up to that $15.5 million amount. So you've got two things going on here. One is the Housing Trust Fund interest, and one is the Community Incentive Fund interest, which I'm going to discuss next. The Community Incentive Fund is a source of competitive small grants and loans that had been made available to local communities for promoting affordable housing near jobs and transportation and for revitalizing downtowns and community centers. For the last several years, as I mentioned, grants have not been made out of this program. Instead, you've been using the interest from what was left that had not been allocated in grants to repay that Housing Trust Fund corpus. So there hasn't been a lot of grants to the local entities out of this source. So basically what we're recommending is that the balance of the Community Incentive Fund, the interest that had otherwise been used to pay back that Housing Trust Fund corpus, and then any interest from the Housing Trust Fund, once that is back up to $15.5 million, be used as a substitute for the $3 million in general fund that legislative fiscal is recommending not be included. So we're looking at $5.3 million, is it 5.3 or 5.1? Thank you. In general fund, rather than $8 million. Does everybody follow so far?
I think so.
Okay.
The bottom line is we're back up at 8.
Yes, we are back up at 8. And as part of this recommendation, we also are taking part of that $5 million in general fund and restoring the Housing Trust Fund to its original 15.5. So by using part of that $5 million to restore the Housing Trust Fund, we now have interest from the Housing Trust Fund that becomes available to fund the Housing Preservation Package. So, okay.
I think this is Exhibit A, and why we're walking through this recommendation today, and we're not going to work it until tomorrow. Senator Whitson.
I was just thinking, just a comment, I was just thinking about taking that description to my banker.
Yeah, that would be long denied. It also raises a very interesting question. Go ahead, Representative Whitson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask if the maneuvers that we will presumably approve as part of this budget are consistent with the policies regarding similar loan and grant programs in other agencies. In other words, do other agencies have the ability to use the interest generated from their corpus to either backfill non-allocated general funds or alternately kind of shore up other accounts?
Matt,
I'm just worried about setting a precedent. That
right.
I understand why we're doing it because of the transfer back in 2003, but I'm...
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, it's my understanding that there were a number of transfers from a number of agencies that occurred, other funds transfers to the State General Fund during the 2001-03 biennium as a result of the recession to backfill other general funded programs. And to a certain extent, you know, housing is a bit unique because they have a number of business programs that do generate interest that enable you to use the dollars. Granted, these are still going to housing programs. There is a policy decision here, and what you're doing here is discontinuing the small community incentive program in favor of a preservation program. So be aware of that, but that is a trade-off for saving $3 million in general fund. So,
and I'm glad that you said it that way, because I think it raises another question, and that's what agencies are assigned to do what functions. This is a duplicative function, as Representative Edwards knows all too well from his time at OECDD. Who appropriately ought to be doing revitalizations of downtowns and community centers? And I would submit that that probably is not appropriate in this portfolio and is in Oregon Economic and Community Development. And so to see the termination of this program in housing, to me, helps true up and make more transparent our budgeting. Now, I don't know whether you guys would agree with that or... You gentlemen is what I meant.
I would agree. I think, you know, when I first came to this agency and looked at the fund, I mean, we kind of coined it the flower pot fund because essentially that's what we were doing, and we're in the housing business, and so I think this is an appropriate transfer, and we're in agreement with it.
The other thing that I would add is it's my understanding that the average grant amount from the community incentive fund was somewhere around, grant or loan amount was somewhere around $80,000. So we're talking very small amounts of money here. There is a local process that is set up to make decisions on the applications and who will be awarded those dollars. But note that housing preservation is an allowable use of those dollars as well. So it's, again, perhaps a slightly different direction than maybe some of the grants in the past, but the way that the statute is written and the rules are written for this particular program, affordable housing is an allowable use.
Madam Chair,
Senator Witz,
I would like to ask questions so that perhaps the gentleman could bring us an answer tomorrow. But it appears that with about $8 million in the preservation expenditures, 300 to 600 units, you're looking at $13,000 to $26,000 per unit to rehabilitate those units and preserve them for low-income housing. Could you give us the mean investment or mean or average even one investment in like a three-bedroom affordable rental housing, whether it be an investment as a subsidy or a cash payment or however, whatever your investment is, your cost, and compare that to the mean average or average investment of in the subsidy in a three-bedroom home or comparable home ownership rental unit or home ownership unit compared to the rental unit compared to what it costs to preserve a unit. If you could do that, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, we'd be happy to do that.
Okay. All right. Let's soldier on till the end of this. But, colleagues, this may warrant revisitation one more time tomorrow. So,
okay,
move ahead.
So the second component of Policy Option Package 102 is the construction of 150 units of supported housing for homeless populations. And this is basically going to be funded through $16 million in lottery bond proceeds. Basically, what would happen here are these would be made available as part of a financing package to developers who agree to also include supported services with these particular units as an eligibility condition of receiving these dollars.
I want to stop and ask a question there. If I'm a developer and what I do is to develop sticks in the ground, units of housing, how do I go about discharging my responsibility to do these, I think what are called wraparound services? Do I contract with a not-for-profit? Do I go out and hire my own people? Do I rely on the agency to help me? I can build the units where, let's say, the drug and alcohol treatment room would occur in my facility that I'm building, but who's responsible for providing the technically competent, credentialed people to actually discharge the services?
Do you want to answer? Okay. Madam Chair, in terms of the services component that we see in terms of the proposals that come to the department, typically it could be contracted out through a community action agency, a local not-for-profit that's willing to come in and partner with the developer in terms of a sponsor to actually do that particular services. Typically, and Mr. Gillespie can correct me, typically I don't believe that the developer takes on the service component as well. They're typically contracting that out. Is that correct? You want to add something?
So when they build the building, they just contemplate that there might be space requirements for XYZ, and they would do that and then contract it out.
That's Madam Chair, that's correct. And again, Bob Gillespie, Housing Division Administrator. We don't expect the housing developers to be experts in service provision. We do ask that they coordinate with community people that would be. So that might be part of their management, that they would have a list of community providers that they can work with or contract with to provide the services.
So is there an element of the community deciding what services they need? Let's assume you have a developer who wants to do developmentally disabled housing in Milwaukee. Are there people in Milwaukee then who could come forward and say, in order to, well, DD might not be a good example. Let's just say homeless. Would then there be some policy creating group in Milwaukee who would say, we would especially like to have services 1, 2, and 3 provided, and we don't really care about 4 and 5? I mean, does somebody make the decision what the facility looks like? Is it done in conjunction with a community action team or the city council or all of the above?
All of the above, Madam Chair. I'd say that there's no set model. It really depends on the population that you're serving and the community that you're in. We had a developer that was developed in Prineville, and he did exactly what you're talking about. He went to all the service providers in the community, did surveys with them, found out what they needed in the relationship. They helped provide clients to live in the affordable housing and the agreement that they'd also provide the services. So he did really extensive outreach. Sometimes if you're surveying a general population of workforce housing, you may not necessarily know what all the service needs are going to be until the housing is developed, at which time you survey the people, you find out what it is that they most need, and then you do the outreach into the community and find those that can do it. But we have a good linkage statewide of both service providers and the developers, that so they can make the connections that are appropriate for the housing that we're developing. I think it works quite successfully.
Thank you. Since this is happening in Milwaukee, I'd like to know.
Me too. I didn't know about it.
It's a great project.
Thank you. How long would this continue? How long would this developer be compelled to continue these programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, we have restrictive covenants that go with the properties. So, and particularly it's tied to the Housing Trust Fund. We have a project use agreement. So if they tell us in the application they're going to make it affordable for 30 years or 40 years or 50 years, we attach that service agreement to that project use agreement and have the expectation that they'll deliver for that time frame, with the understanding that you have to be realistic about it, because several things can happen. Number one, the populations can change. So you might have to modify the services as a new population moves in. And it also is quite frankly dependent upon funding to those nonprofit service providers. If the funding goes away, then you have to begin looking for alternative means to try to accomplish the same thing. So we have a person on staff that actually works in the asset property management division that helps people in those situations where the funding has gone away. Let's say it's for the chronically mentally ill. If the organization has been providing the services as a local nonprofit no longer receives funding, then we'll find another nonprofit or find some other way to deliver as appropriate services as we can. It's a matter of working with the people.
Thank you.
Ms. Dyser.
And I would just note that for the purpose of this particular package provides dollars to the extent that it's contemplated that these would be funded for up to 10 years as supported housing for the homeless. And it's my understanding that for purposes of this particular package, the application would work out the types of services and all of that beforehand, before funds were granted. So the developer would have to be working with those folks before they ever came to the department so that they would know what they were awarding for purposes of their consolidated funding cycle.
Senator Verger, with apologies.
That's all right, Madam Chair. This isn't a policy committee, but I just have to say that the purpose of those social services that you're adding into the affordable housing units should really be working themselves out of a job. The idea is that you're supposed to be there to help people learn how to have better life skills and then go away and let them support themselves. Otherwise, you're just an enabler. And so you're going to be continuing to not only enable the parents, but enable the children of those parents. And so I think that I have some real strong feelings about helping people that need it, but not putting people in a dependency role on your agency.
Okay. Ms. Dyster, are we at a stopping point right now? We're about to talk about policy option 801.
We can just as easily stop here. That's fine.
Okay. So, colleagues, the plan is to come back tomorrow to finish this in-depth walkthrough of the LFO recommendation, to entertain any other questions, particularly to perhaps hear the tale of the several consolidations one more time so that we're all completely sure about what we're moving forward. And I want to just put on the record at this point, we are dealing with the budget and the policy question encapsulated in House Bill 3551 as two entirely different things. And so this doesn't contemplate any revenue out of 3551.
Correct.
Okay. I think we might keep that in our minds, but also maybe have the opportunity to talk about how additional revenue into the agency would affect some of these programmatic areas. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Since we're talking about policy, I think I just would like it on the record that I'm sort of uncomfortable that this agency goes to several different committees to present their policy issues, and I'm somewhat uncomfortable that it's not one particular issue or one particular committee that you respond to. I think that would give us a clearer idea of what's going on in the agency, and I know I'm naive in regards to ways and means, but I guess I'd just like it on the record that I would prefer that there would be one policy committee that dealt with these issues.
Well, the budget would still ultimately have to come through here, but I think some of the resolution to some of the policy questions might benefit from a trip through policy committees other than tied to specified bills. Any other concluding comments, colleagues?
Tomorrow, Madam Chair, I would like to understand what's left in Package 102.
We're going to have plenty of opportunity to finish this discussion, revisit some of the complexities, because, frankly, I think if somebody asked me to recite what Ms. Dyster shared with us, I'm not sure I could make a clear bead from point A to point B. So, all right, any other comments before the committee? Then we stand adjourned until tomorrow.